Hello and welcome to Beyond Reproach.
Hello. This is Steph. Oh, damn it. Now I screwed it up.
You screwed it up. Quit trying to be me.
I'm.
This is Stephanie Domingo.
I'm Tux Screw It Up Lurzel.
This is the show about scandals and scandalousness in American politics and government.
When I was a kid at school learning the golden rule, teacher often used to say, if you don't tell a lie, there's not a reason why you can't be like Washington someday. How could Washington be a married man and never, never tell a lie?
We're here with some cocktails.
Some fancy secret cocktails.
Yeah, this is the first time that I don't know what we're drinking.
I kept this one a secret from Stephanie for good reason. Let's take a sip.
Should we cheers first? Cheers.
Yeah. Okay. Ooh. What do you think?
Whoa. It's very tropical.
Mm-hmm.
Very fruity. Is there coconut in this?
No coconut.
Hmm.
I'm not going to say a word until I'm going to let you tell your thoughts before I even tell what this is or...
It almost tastes like, maybe it's just the color, like milky. Is there cream in here?
So this is milk punch.
Oh, this is a milk punch.
This is Ben Franklin's milk punch recipe.
Wow. It's very light.
Yeah.
But it's so fruity.
There's a lot of lemon in it. It's brandy, lemon, milk, and nutmeg and water. And that's it.
That's it?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's just the combination of milk and lemon that's...
It takes on a very different flavor from what you would think. Because it's not aged, but you like...
So it kind of tastes like something that I don't want to say. It tastes good.
Mm-hmm.
But it kind of tastes like Tums.
Tums?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
A little bit.
There is a little bit of a... I wouldn't say Tums, but there is almost a little bit of a medicinal quality to
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Maybe it's the spiciness. Milk punch, eh?
Yeah.
Not bad.
The original recipe, Ben Franklin's recipe, which is what I used, was not very clear on exactly how it should be strained. Milk punch is sort of having this like resurgence in cocktail culture right now. And there's very specific rules on how it's supposed to be strained. And it shouldn't be this cloudy. But it's good.
Yeah. Do you taste the lemon?
It doesn't taste like lemon.
No.
Yeah.
And
there's
a lot
of lemon in it. So you zest a bunch of lemons and let the lemon zest soak in the brandy for 24 hours.
Brandy isn't fruity, is it?
No.
Tastes very strange.
It's just lemon. Yeah.
Just lemon.
You soak the lemon zest in the brandy and then you strain it out and then add lemon juice and milk. Hot milk with brandy and lemon juice, and then it curdles. And then you strain the curds out. So essentially what we're drinking is just the whey.
Oh, okay.
I have mentioned milk punch before.
You have, yeah.
It was an episode in season one. We were talking about eggnog.
Yes.
And I mentioned that there was a version of milk punch that tastes similar to eggnog. This is not that version.
No, definitely
That not. Version is actually much more recent. I think it's called either Southern Milk Punch or sometimes called New Orleans Milk Punch.
Mm.
That one came around sometime in the early 1900s or 1950s maybe even. This one is much older. This one has been around for centuries. It's been around for centuries in America. It did kind of go away for a while, but it is experiencing a resurgence in modern cocktail culture.
Like you can get this at a bar?
It's like really fancy, overpriced cocktail lounges.
Everyone's wearing suspenders.
Yeah, totally. The recipe that I am using is from 1763. This was handwritten by Benjamin Franklin in a letter to a friend who asked him for the recipe.
Wow, very
this
good.
This is exactly Benjamin Franklin's recipe from 1763 that we're drinking.
It is delicious.
Yeah. This is called English milk punch, but today we call it clarified milk punch. When this recipe was sort of invented, there were some other cocktails that were made in a similar style. There was something called posset and something called syllabub. Possets combine hot milk with ale, wine, or brandy, sugar, and spices.
Hmm.
The combination of heat and alcohol curdled the milk. They were not strained, but they would be consumed through the spout of a posset cup, which let you drink the whey from the bottom and then save the curd to be eaten at the end. Syllabubs would combine milk with wine and lemon juice or other acids, and the acid in the wine would curdle the milk. And when served in a glass, the foamy curd would sit on top and would be eaten with a spoon before you drank the cocktail.
Hmm.
So this is not a weird thing to do in the 1700s. Jerry Thomas had some recipes in his cocktail book in the 1860s. So it's kind of gross when you're making it because the milk curdles and then you have to strain it out.
Yeah.
Well, gross for modern people. But even by the 1860s, when Jerry Thomas wrote his book, it was considered gross.
Oh.
So he wrote in his book, there was like a little caption under one of the recipes. Do not suffer anyone of delicate appetite to to see the melange in its present state, as the sight might create distaste for the punch once perfected.
Ooh, it's like avert your eyes.
Yeah, don't look at it when it's all curdly. Curdly. Are you glad that I didn't tell you there was milk in it before you tasted it? Curdled milk.
I don't think I would have freaked out, but like it exactly. doesn't taste like milk at all.
Yeah. Anyways, I'm saying all that to say that this recipe originally is from 1763, but the scandal that I'm doing today is actually much later, from the 1850s.
Okay.
But it still would have been. Yeah. People were still drinking still this drinking in the 1850s. It. You may or may not have guessed, but my story is going to be about milk today.
Oh, I was thinking it was going to be about Ben Franklin. But he was dead by then. What
yeah,
are we talking
yeah,
about?
Yeah, that's what, yeah.
That makes no sense.
I just wanted to use his recipe.
He's 200 years old.
Yeah. I could have used one of Jerry Thomas's recipes because it would have been more time period appropriate.
Yeah.
But I just thought making Benjamin Franklin's recipe, like original recipe handwritten, was so cool that I wanted
this
to do
amazing.
That.
This is amazing. I wonder if he had it cold or did he have it warm?
It was supposed to be served cold.
I believe it was? Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Or at least cool. I don't know if it would have been cold. Back then.
Now I'm grossed out.
Well, so speaking of being grossed out, before I dive in, I'm going to stop here real quick to drop a little trigger warning.
I wish I was given a trigger warning the first time I learned that some people have milk with dinner. I was raised to vomit.
Not at home, but at my grandma's house, I always had milk with dinner. The only time we didn't have milk with dinner is if we were eating pizza. My grandma made pizza, homemade pizza, and we got Pepsi.
You should be getting Pepsi with everything.
No.
Well, I mean, you shouldn't
need to have Pepsi,
Pepsi water. At every meal. There's something about milk and like meat that makes me sick. Mm. But all right, go on with your real trigger warning.
I'm going to take one more sip.
It's very good.
I don't tend to drink that much while I'm talking, so I just want to have a few sips before I get into it.
How much alcohol is in this?
It's pretty strong. There's a lot of brandy in it. There's more brandy than anything else.
Ooh. I've been abstaining from alcohol, you guys. I did a fairly sober September. I drank on Labor Day, but I also drank on my boyfriend's birthday.
And we drank in Fire Island.
Oh, shit. Okay. I was not very sober. Let me stop my lies. Sober for me.
Yeah.
I'm like, I'm just going to drink for the podcast. Or whenever we're having fun.
We got real drunk in Fire Island and kind of made fools of ourselves.
Oh, we most certainly did. But we had the funnest night of our life, though, that we don't remember.
Oh my God. I danced with drag queens all night long.
I jumped into a pool.
That we were not supposed to be in and got
That was closed for the season.
Yeah.
I jumped in with all of my clothes except for my shoes. I'm like, I don't want to get my shoes wet.
That was what you thought of.
That's what I thought of.
That's so funny. Okay, back to milk. So I'm going to offer you a little trigger warning because I have a hell of a story today. This is a very scandalous story, kind of centered around illness and death.
Okay.
And I'm sorry to say this. This is going to come up in the story. So if you don't want to hear this, maybe skip ahead like 20 minutes. A lot of the death in my story is of young children and babies, mostly babies. The story will also include some descriptions of animal cruelty. And some of the story is just plain gross. Like, seriously disgusting.
Okay. This is rude. Now I'm upset.
Yeah.
Because this story has all these trigger warnings, and it's about milk, and it's disgusting. And I'm like, okay, hopefully I don't vomit.
Yeah.
But
well, the moral of the story is don't listen while you're eating dinner.
Yeah.
But
drinking milk.
Well, please do be drinking milk punch.
Okay.
You've got the recipe. We're posting our recipes on Instagram the week before the episodes go live, so you can drink along with us. I don't know if anyone actually wants to drink milk punch with us.
Well, it's actually really good.
It's so tasty.
But I'm scared about this story.
You've been warned. I'm going to dive right in, and it starts from the beginning. So, New York City in the early 1800s. Thousands of babies were shriveling to death every year from uncontrollable diarrhea. And without modern medical technology and advanced diagnostics, old-timey doctors struggled to identify a cause and kind of just collectively shrugged. They were like, you've got ghosts in the blood, you should do cocaine about it.
That's hilarious.
Yeah. That was basically the extent of medical science at that time, so it's not really a big surprise that they couldn't figure out what was going on and what was causing the death of all these children. The thing was, there were some people that knew what was going on, and they were trying to get the word out, but no one was listening to them, thanks to booze, capitalism, and corrupt Tammany Hall politicians.
Ooh, Tammany Hall, yes. Notoriously corrupt.
According to the failing New York Times,
yes.
In the 1850s, about 8,000 babies were dying every single year in New York City. Yeah, in New York City alone, 8,000 a year. But while the problem had started in the 1820s or 30s, and some people knew the cause by the 1840s, it wasn't until 1858 that an enterprising newspaperman found a way to get people to pay attention. Once they were listening, he really milked the story, though, in a series of scathing exposés. So here's how it all started. At the turn of the 19th century, Brooklyn and Manhattan were growing and growing fast. As the population exploded and people started living closer and closer together, it soon became abundantly clear that the old ways of raising food for people living in cities wasn't working anymore. All the new housing was crowding out the old farms that used to feed city dwellers in years past, and pastures were forced to move farther and farther into rural areas surrounding cities. While these farmers could have much more land than they did before, they were also much farther from the population that they were trying to feed. Since these were the days before refrigeration and tractor trailers, the further away a farmer was from their marketplace, the greater the likelihood that their food would spoil before delivery. Not only that, but increased transportation costs meant that fresh food would cost more for city people.
City slickers.
Sweaty slickers. Food would cost more for city slickers, and the urban poor was straight up priced out of eating well.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah.
What?
I'm shocked. While certain foods like salted or cured meats or even certain types of vegetables could last several days or weeks without refrigeration, other farm products spoiled much more quickly. One product in particular spoiled super fast without refrigeration and also happened to be incredibly vital to a growing urban population. That product was...
milk!
Milk!
Wow.
Around this same time, new economic and societal pressures were pushing women to wean their babies sooner, so the demand for milk was ever increasing.
Mm.
Poor women were weaning early because they had to return to the workforce to keep their households afloat. And upper and middle class women were not expected to work, but they were expected to pop out lots of babies. And polite society expected them to spend their time running their households and making social calls rather than breastfeeding, which, much like today, was considered immodest.
Oh, yes.
The first prepared infant food was not invented until 1865. So before that, women had two choices. You either hire a wet nurse, if you could afford one, or you feed your baby something else.
Like what?
I've read a lot of stuff about like mashed, essentially baby food, like people like mashing up carrots and stuff, but giving it to infants that were way too young to eat that kind of food.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So without a real understanding of how nutrition worked, the common belief in those years was that pure cow's milk was a nutritious and effective substitute for human breast milk.
Why would you think this?
Sometime in the 1820s, a few enterprising farmers devised a plan to make a cheap, fresh milk available to mothers in the city's densest and poorest neighborhoods. Since the best container for delivering unspoiled milk to the public was a live cow, they decided to keep their cows in the city and crowd them into cramped warehouses to maximize their yield. Since the cows wouldn't have access to pasture, though, they had to come up with a plan to find a cheap and ready food source for them. There was also...
oh, no.
Yeah. So there was also another liquid in high demand in growing cities in the 1800s. Do you want to venture to guess what that might have been?
Booze.
Whiskey, specifically. Since urban distilleries were just throwing away the spent grain that they'd used to make their whiskey.
Oh no.
These new distilleries could buy it up for a song. Before long, the distilleries saw a missed opportunity and went into the dairy business themselves. Some distilleries would attach metal sheds to their facilities and pipe the hot grain waste directly into the cow's troughs to eat.
Ew.
While others decided to outsource the labor and convert their warehouses into stall farms that they'd rent out in a system similar to tenant farming. Either way, they could turn their spent grain mash, which used to just be a waste product to be disposed of, into huge profits. It was a masterclass in recycling.
So sustainable.
Yeah. The grain mash, which was also called swill, had a much higher calorie count than regular grass. So the cows that were eating swill actually produced significantly more milk than they would have if they had been just raised on some picturesque pastoral like green grassland.
Okay.
There was only one problem. Cows are not meant to eat fermented distillery waste. I know.
Since
that's
when?
A real
says
shocker.
You. Yeah. Says you.
Yeah.
Fake news.
Yeah. In Taming Manhattan, Dr. Catherine McNurr writes, When introduced to the boiling liquid, cows typically refused to eat for a few days until desperation drove them to consume the slop.
Oh no.
Hundreds or sometimes thousands of dairy cows were tied up in individual stalls so narrow that they could never turn around. And most of them were trapped in the same place for their entire lives.
Well, that's kind of how it is today.
Yeah. The stalls were rarely cleaned, so they were often standing in deep piles of their own manure. There was also almost no ventilation, so you can imagine the smell. Not only that, but the swill they were being fed was slowly killing them. McNor writes, "A diet consisting exclusively of the swill made cows sick, led to ulcerated sores all over their bodies, and caused their tails to fall off."
And this is before antibiotics.
Yeah.
That we can just pump them full and continue to consume
exactly.
Their byproducts.
Yes.
Okay.
Their diet was also causing their teeth to rot out.
Oh, no!
The foul air in these stall farms was causing lung infections. They were covered in flies and open sores. And some of these cows were so sick that they couldn't even stand up on their own. But when that happened, the dairy owners would just prop them up and keep on milking until they died.
Wow.
When they did die, the dairy owners would then have them butchered and sell the foul meat to the same urban poor that were buying the swill milk.
Ew, that's gross.
It's so fucking gross.
Oh, man.
Somehow, though, even in these horrible conditions, these cows were producing a ton of milk. A ton. Some reports say that they were pumping out between 5 and 25 times more milk than they would have if they were eating grass. 25 times more milk.
Well, it's because they're having something that has all these calories.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
Grass has like no calories.
Yeah. Do you think that cows fed swill grain mash would produce milk that is every bit as delicious and nutritious as grass-fed milk?
Something tells me no.
Yeah.
That it would make some babies sick.
Yeah. Well, context clues.
I have a feeling, you guys.
I don't know. I'm just getting this
from the universe. I was holding some crystals.
Yes.
And they told me. I don't know if crystals tell people things.
They make people feel things.
Oh, is that what it is? Okay.
Moving on. Any of you crystal havers out there,
people
feel free to tell us how crystals make you feel. Or if they tell you things. Anyways, back to the swill milk.
No, back to crystals. Just kidding.
So, you're correct. The answer was nope.
Oh.
So, milk from these swill-fed cows was thin and watery.
Ew.
With off flavors, and it usually
had a weird... alcohol in it?
No. The cows were probably drunk all the time, though.
Yeah. Drunk and sick
and covered
in sores.
Yes. So, it had off flavors, and it usually had a weird bluish tint to it.
No.
Yes.
Blue?
Bluish.
What?
So, imagine yourself... You're a poor garment worker with a gaggle of hungry spawn back at your tenement apartment. You go down to the corner market and all you find is this weird, thin, watery blue milk. Do you want to feed that to your babies?
Absolutely not.
Again, the answer is nope.
Definitely not.
So now I have a multiple choice question for you.
Oh, what do you do?
Yeah. Imagine now you're no longer a poor garment worker. Now you're a mustachioed, wealthy distillery/dairy owner with a bunch of blue milk that you have to unload.
Oh, are you going to dye it or something?
Do you A, pour your disgusting sick cow juice down the drain and go back to slinging whiskey? B,
no.
Send the cows to cow sanctuaries in the green pastures of New Jersey?
Hell no.
C, repent your evil ways and devote your life to the Lord?
That's a good option.
Or D, do you adulterate that milk so it looks like the nice, thick, white, healthy milk people expect it to?
Yeah, like what we do with salmon. I'm going to go with D.
D. The correct answer is D. You get that money, honey.
Yeah. You secure the bag.
These dairy owners would stir in any number of highly nutritious additives.
Oh, no.
Such as flour. Rotten eggs.
Stop it.
Starch.
Stop this.
Burnt sugar. Molasses.
Ooh.
Chalk.
Oh, what?
Or plaster of Paris.
Wait, what? What is plaster? Is it plaster?
It's like what walls are made out of.
Why are they trying to kill
Among
people?
Other things. Because it made the milk look white. There's a lot of babies being born, so there's always going to be a customer.
Oh, I guess like
this is also,
adults aren't drinking the milk.
Yeah, it's more babies. And this is also at a time in New York's history when there's a constant steady stream of immigrants coming from like Ireland and Europe.
Europe.
They were going to have customers no matter what.
Yeah. They were like OG blacks.
This was all in an effort to make the milk taste sweeter and look thicker and whiter and more like milk.
Though chalk.
Chalk and plaster. Rotten eggs. Yeah. No big deal. In poor neighborhoods all over the city, the local milk wagons and street corner vendors were emblazoned with wholesome looking signs for pure country milk and pure Orange County milk to trick these poor, exhausted mothers into thinking that they were buying a wholesome, healthy, and unadulterated food source for their families. By the late 1830s, swill milk made up between 50 and 80% of all milk consumed in America's largest northeastern cities.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Well, New York City was not the only city where swill milk was being produced. It was by far the worst city and the most dangerous city to consume it. In the 1840s, a temperance reformer named Robert Hartley tried to draw attention to the issue by publishing a report exposing the unsanitary conditions in the swill milk system and linking it to infant mortality. The problem was that New Yorkers then, much like New Yorkers today, loved their hooch. Since Hartley was a temperance reformer, most people thought he was just trying to make the dairies look bad because they were run by distilleries and he had an anti-distillery agenda to push. Skepticism wasn't the only thing keeping his whistleblowing from gaining traction, though. This was also before germ theory had really gained any widespread acceptance, and the public just did not understand that unsanitary conditions could have any link to disease. Not only that, but wealthy distillery owners also had piles of money to keep government officials and politicians in their pockets. So they basically didn't have to worry about any government regulation or interference. Since their horrifically disgusting dairy cows were hidden away in windowless shacks, it was easy for them to keep the truth from the public. By the late 1840s, scientists were pumping out even more evidence showing that this stuff was dangerous to the health of children. Literally one half of the children born in the city were dying before the age of five, mostly thanks to tuberculosis, typhoid, and diarrhea-causing bacteria in swill milk.
That's crazy. But unsurprising, given all the additives.
Seriously,
this milk.
Yeah.
They're just putting poison into the milk.
Yeah.
And being
yeah.
like, oh, wait, babies are getting sick?
And it was more the milk itself was like had disease in it than the actual additives. I'm sure the additives were killing people too, but...
Yeah.
The press started to join the chorus and sound the alarm about the distillery farms, but most people still were not listening. The dairies claimed to be offering a healthy, wholesome product, and consumers were not really savvy enough yet to even wrap their heads around the concept of false advertising. This was, mind you, about 60 or 70 years before truth in advertising laws and the creation of the Federal Trade Commission.
And before Snopes.
Yeah. Yes, also before yes, Snopes,
it's
yeah.
True. It's true, yes.
A very important distinction to make, yes.
You know, I add in where I can.
It was not until Frank Leslie's Illustrated newspaper took on swill milk in 1858 that people finally started to pay attention. In a 5,000-word expose, Leslie's Illustrated paper called out a group of Brooklyn and Manhattan distilleries as milk murderers who had distributed liquid poison to the unsuspecting masses. From the article... For the midnight assassin, we have the rope and the gallows. For the robber, the penitentiary.
Penitentiary.
Penitentiary. But for those who murder our children by the thousands, we have neither reprobation nor punishment.
Wow.
They are not penal villains, but licensed traitors. And though their traffic is literally in human life, the government seems powerless or unwilling to interfere. An article from the Times detailed the events that led up to Leslie's crusade against the dairies. Quote, unpromising matter stood when Frank Leslie found left at his door, as milk, a disgusting dose of milk and pus.
Ew.
Bound to know the worst of the horrible stories, he analyzed the specimen and then dispatched his corps of reporters and artists to the headquarters of the poison. He has reproduced pictures that are true to the life and so shocking that the very word milk turns the stomach. The whole town suffers nausea.
Yuck.
To spread the word... And to sell papers, Leslie took out full-page ads in competing newspapers. He advertised his swill milk expose series in a bold, dramatic headlines like, "Are you aware what kind of milk you're drinking?" Then in his own paper, he published detailed maps showing the exact street corners where swill milk was being sold, along with locations of the dairies that were producing it.
Good for him.
He told his illustrators to find ways to infiltrate the dairies, too, and to add visuals to his exposés. We are going to share some of the original illustrations on our Instagram. They're gross.
Yeah.
But they're also history, so sorry. Unfortunately, along with the detailed descriptions of the foul conditions of the dairies, his articles also portrayed Irish dairy workers in offensive ways that stirred up anti-immigrant sentiment in New York. Some of the dairy workers were so upset that they actually attacked a few of the paper's illustrators. The whole city was thrown into an uproar, and when angry mobs started building up outside of the distillery's doors, the city's common council was pressured to investigate, regulate the dairies, and punish their owners. The council sent out a team of aldermen to conduct inspections, but as it turned out, some of the aldermen were on the side of the distillery owners and had given them advance notice to clean up their stables before they arrived. According to McNair, after hearings and inconclusive chemical analyses, the majority of the committee voted in favor of keeping swill milk, recommending only that the sheds have better ventilation.
Ew.
3 days later, Leslie and his paper published another illustration, this one showing New York's corrupt city politicians painting the sickly cows white, with one of the distillers slipping a bag of money into Alderman Michael Tuomi's pockets. Tuomi was well known as a puppet of New York's famously corrupt Tammany Hall political machine. When he was sent to, quote, investigate one particularly notorious dairy on West 16th Street, Tuomi sat down with the owners, drank a glass or two of whiskey, and concluded that the swill milk was just as good for children as ordinary milk. He even said that anyone who refused to drink it simply had a prejudice.
That's amazing.
When Frank Leslie's newspaper...
I'm sorry, now I'm the giggles. Okay.
Sorry. When Frank Leslie's newspaper staked out distillery owner Bradish Johnson's mansion at 21st and Broadway, his reporters noted that in the midst of the ongoing investigation, Tuomi was seen making several late-night visits to the distillery owner's mansion, I should say. Yes.
Oh.
Imagine that.
Yeah.
Tuomi went on to assume a central role in the investigations of the dairies, and along with fellow aldermen E. Harrison Reed and William Tucker, they did everything in their power to shield the dairies from prosecution or fines. Tuomi went on to turn the hearings against the health authorities and tried to make any critics of the dairies look ridiculous, even going to the extent of arguing that swill milk was actually better for children than regular milk.
That's hilarious.
Along with his Tammany Hall cronies, Tuomi successfully blocked any serious inquiries into the dairies and squashed all of the many calls for reform.
Wow.
He even earned himself the nickname Swill Milk Tuomi for years to come. The Board of Health went ahead and exonerated the distilleries.
What?
Thanks to Tammany, yeah. But public outcry continued. The New York Academy of Medicine carried out an examination and established an official connection between swill milk and the increased infant mortality in the city. Leslie's newspaper alleged that the deaths of 2/3 of the children in New York and Brooklyn could distinctly be traced to the use of impure milk. And the New York...
Wait, 2/3?
2/3 of all the deaths were tied to swill milk.
Wow, that's insane.
Yeah. And then the New York Times openly questioned how the 8,000 children that died last year from the poison of swill milk could not spur public health officials and local leaders into action. With Tuomi and the Tammany government continuing to block any official reforms, public outcry caused a significant decline in demand for milk, which ended up forcing many of the dairies and distilleries to either close altogether or to clean up their operations, at least enough to gain back public trust. Even as this was happening, it was basically like, because there was no regulation, the public sort of self-regulated the dairies.
Yeah.
Leslie kept up with his activism and his paper and was still writing about the story. In 1862, 4 years after his first exposé, the New York State Legislature finally passed the first ever food safety laws. First ever.
Wow.
Food safety laws in 1862.
That's scary.
In the form of milk regulations.
Good, finally.
Unfortunately, problems with milk adulteration continued. And the city had to pass another law in 1875 to prohibit the sale of any milk from distillery-fed cows.
Good.
But by the turn of the century, while all the distillery-owned dairies had closed, the lure of cheap food from the distilleries was still too much of a draw for dairy owners. Even though the dairies were no longer owned by the distilleries, dairy owners were still buying up the swill.
What? Oh, because it produced so much milk.
Yeah, and it was cheap. And it was so cheap.
Because it's a waste product.
And there's no grass in Brooklyn. There's not enough dairy cows to, you know. So in 1904, a new health commissioner found that thousands of cows were still being fed distillery slop in Brooklyn. In 1904. Thankfully, though, advances in rail transportation were finally making it possible to get fresh, cold milk into the city from the surrounding rural farms. But while swill milk and other adulterated milk were becoming less and less of a problem, milk-borne diseases like tuberculosis were still prevalent. Louis Pasteur had invented the process of pasteurization, which involves heating milk to kill germs and bacteria, in 1862. But before widespread understanding of germ theory, the average consumer was slow to warm up to the idea. It was more expensive, and it sometimes affected the flavor of the milk, so people just didn't want to do it and didn't really see the point. Enter Nathan Strauss, the owner of Macy's, who decided to open milk pasteurizing depots all over the city as part of a campaign to get the public used to the idea of pasteurization. These depots were a combination laboratory and recreation center, complete with a small pasteurizing and bottling plant visible to the public. The first depot was such a success that Strauss opened 6 more the following year, and by 1906 he had 17 depots throughout the city with a centralized milk plant to meet demand. Statistics showed that thanks to pasteurization, the childhood mortality rate had dropped by half.
Wow, and that's amazing.
Yeah, and by this point, New York City set the standard for the safest milk supply in the nation. By 1905, all of the city's milk traders had to be licensed, and all of their suppliers had to agree to inspections of their creameries and farms. Pasteurization became mandatory in New York City in 1910. In 1906, 50 years after the swill milk scandal, but very much inspired by it, Congress finally passed the Pure Food and Drug Act, which prevented the manufacture, sale, or transportation of adulterated or misbranded or poisonous or deleterious foods, drugs, medicines, or liquor. That's a mouthful.
Finally, yes.
Oddly enough, the federal government never actually passed any laws making pasteurization of milk mandatory.
Oh.
I thought it was. But
I thought it was too.
It's state mandated.
Are there some states that don't mandate?
Generally, everyone does, but it's easier to buy raw milk in some states versus others. Yeah. So in 1924, they officially, the federal government officially, quote, recommended grade A pasteurization, but the actual laws surrounding it were left to the states to decide.
Okay.
It is currently illegal to sell raw milk in only 15 states, but most other states have strict laws limiting how and where it can be sold. The only federal laws about raw milk that were ever passed federally were passed starting in 1973.
Wow.
Regulating interstate shipping of raw milk.
Okay.
So you can...
You can buy it, but you can't ship it to certain states because it's illegal.
You can't ship it across state lines. It doesn't matter where it's being produced. It can't be shipped across state lines.
Wow.
Yeah.
Even if you're shipping it to a place that's legal?
Mm-mm.
Okay.
It can only be produced and sold in the same state.
Okay. Well, that makes sense, actually.
The swill milk scandal itself kind of went away almost on its own because of advances in technology and transportation.
Mm-hmm.
But then even after the swill milk and the adulterated milk kind of went away, they were still dealing with the disease that goes along with raw milk. Even today, when you're consuming raw milk, generally today you're consuming milk from a dairy that's clean and like sanitary and everything is stainless steel and blah, blah, blah. But dairy farms are always going to have some sort of disease happening unless they have like 2 cows.
Mm-hmm.
There is always a risk.
And especially for kids.
Absolutely.
Because adults, like raw milk isn't, I mean, maybe it'll kill you, but it's like...
You're much more likely to get sick if you're young or old.
Old, yeah.
Or have some sort of compromised immune system.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
But this whole
Milk's
thing,
not getting me.
Yeah. But the whole thing kind of goes back to like the idea of the need for consumer protections in general. Like people didn't even know that it was a thing to lie that this milk wasn't really milk. I mean, it was milk, but it wasn't what they thought it was that they were consuming.
Ugh.
And then today we have these like raw milk advocates who, I mean, mostly ignorant of the swill milk scandal and the real history of why we should be.
They're just like, oh, the government wants me to do this nanny state sort of thing.
Exactly. A lot of libertarians are really gung-ho about raw milk because...
Oh, the libertarians.
Yeah. They quote personal choice arguments saying that regulation of raw milk is nothing more than unnecessary government interference and that their choice to consume it is not harming anyone but themselves.
I mean, they're not wrong there.
Yeah, they're not wrong. Today, we don't really have to worry about tuberculosis so much anymore. We don't have to worry about typhoid.
I mean, whooping cough is back.
Yeah. But even in these like stainless steel sanitary dairies, we're still seeing things like salmonella and E. coli. The CDC says that you are 150 times more likely to develop an illness from consuming raw milk over pasteurized. Whenever a new state allows sales of raw milk, there is always a subsequent increase in milk-borne illness.
Really?
Yeah.
Always?
Always.
Always.
People say that it's like good for your allergies and it's good for like digestive health and all this stuff.
Yeah.
So I've always been curious about it. But now after researching this, I'm like, I like being alive.
I like raw cheese.
Well, raw cheese is different because depending on how long it's aged.
Yeah.
That kills most of the bacteria anyways.
Oh, okay.
The only issue you have to worry about is soft cheeses, because they're not aged as long as hard cheeses, which is why it is illegal to import soft cheeses from, like, Europe, from France.
Yeah, that's where I have my raw soft cheeses, and they're delicious.
They're fucking delicious.
They're so good.
Yeah.
I'm like, why can't I have this where
there's
I
also,
am?
I believe that there's ways of testing the cheese to make sure that they don't have these...
I would assume there is, because Europe is crazy about, like, making sure consumers are safe.
Yeah, and we're also missing out, because France's soft cheeses...
You haven't had Italy's, but yes.
Yeah, that's true. I have not had Italy's. But, like, there are cheeses that we are currently consuming in the United States that are being made with pasteurized milk, but they should not be.
Yes.
And as Americans, we don't know what we're missing.
No, we don't.
Camembert and brie and...
Yeah.
There are so many cheeses that we don't know what they actually are supposed to taste like. And then once you go to France, you're like, brie is garbage. American brie
I mean, I
is
don't
garbage.
Eat it here. Yeah. Never. I've seen a better way.
Swill milk.
Yikes.
Cheers
okay.
to... That's why I made a milk punch.
Wow. To horrify me.
Yes.
That was a great story. I had no clue.
Yeah.
No clue that babies were drinking this like sick milk and so many of them were dying and no one cared for so long.
And that's why we pasteurize milk today.
Wow.
Or one of many reasons, but yeah.
That's insane.
Leave it to Brooklyn and in New York City to
find
a way to put fucking chalk in milk.
Plaster, if anything, should not be consumed.
Nope.
Great story.
Thank you.
Awesome.
I need to use the ladies' lounge and pour myself another glass of milk punch.
Wait, do we have another glass?
Oh, we have a lot.
Did you make a punch?
I made a punch. I cut the recipe.
So I don't have to tell your mom again?
I swear to this his recipe, Ben Franklin's recipe, makes like enough to feed to
feed me
drink a huge crowd of people.
Whoa.
A lot of punch. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we have
another.
We have
this
a lot.
This is delicious.
Yeah.
Cool.
All right. Be right back. Yeah. And we're back.
We are back.
With more cocktails.
Delicious.
Milk punch.
Milky punches.
It's so good.
It is really good.
Yeah. Yesterday I tasted it and it was very lemony.
Yeah, it's because you put so many lemons in it.
Yeah.
So
Ben Franklin's recipe originally called for 6 quarts of brandy.
Unbelievable.
And 44 lemons.
You just walk into the store. Can I have all of your lemons?
Yeah, exactly.
Just
how do you even get 44 lemons?
I don't even know what that looks like.
63.
Yeah, seriously.
Yeah.
Seriously.
He was rich.
True.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we're back.
We are back. We're back with my story that's like 100 years later. So I'm just going to jump in. Did you know that JFK felt the same way about Fidel Castro that Trump feels about President Obama?
I never thought about it that way before.
I mean, I didn't read that anywhere, but like looking into the scandal, I'm just like, oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
The obsession
is
really something special.
Oh my God, are we doing Bay of Pigs?
No. Oh. No, Bay of Pigs is boring. Okay. I mean, I'm mentioning it because I feel like everyone knows about the Bay of Pigs.
Yeah.
I'm doing the Cupin Project.
Ooh,
do you know the Cupin Project?
I don't.
Yes. Oh, you're in for a treat. So the Cupin Project, codename Operation Mongoose, was a secret government. Do you know this?
I've heard of Operation Mongoose. Yeah.
It's a secret U.S. government sponsored terrorism campaign blessed by JFK, whose sole mission was to topple the Castro regime.
I don't know why, but I am grinning from ear to ear.
It's no, like, this, I haven't even this heard is enjoyable. I mean, it's horribly fucked up.
Well, my horribly. Story was awful. So
yeah, this no, is, this is one a, is fun.
Yeah.
It's really fun. So the goal of Operation Mongoose was to replace the administration with one more favorable to American interests. The plan was a series of preposterous covert plots created and undertaken by multiple U.S. agencies. I know that I will have done my job if by the end of the episode, everyone feels like they could have had a wildly successful career at the CIA in the 1960s if they just had one good idea on how to secretly overthrow the government. Just one good idea.
Damn.
Because this is full of, I'm not going to spoil it, but the worst ideas you've ever heard in your life. So first, the briefest and most oversimplified view of Cuban history you will ever hear. The U.S. first invaded Cuba in the Spanish-American War in 1898. Following formal independence in 1902, Cuba understandably went through decades of instability. There were revolts, coups, and a period of military occupation. Guantanamo, ever heard of it?
Never heard of it.
Cuba was kind of like low-key an unofficial colony. Skipping forward to the administration of Fulgencio Batista, a former soldier turned elected president of Cuba from 1940 to 1944. He claimed a second term in 1952 by seizing power in a military coup. He canceled the elections that year and declared himself the winner, as one does, you know.
Wow.
Yeah. Although Batista had been relatively progressive in his first term, he was on some bullshit in his second. So much so that even though the U.S. armed and propped him up, even they were like, okay, he's doing too much. You can't cancel the election.
This is sounding very reminiscent of Panama and Noriega.
Yes, it is very much in that vein.
Yeah.
Yes. So enter stage left, a powerfully bearded young Fidel Castro Ruz. His rise to power had been watched by the CIA since 1948, when he was still in law school. He was identified in one of the earliest declassified report as, quote, one of the young student leaders in Cuba who manages to get himself involved in many things that do not concern him. Which is hella rich coming from the CIA.
Yeah.
It's like, why are you here?
Yeah, who asked
what?
You?
He gets involved in things that don't concern him?
Seriously.
Okay. Huh.
And you know about it for what reason exactly?
Yeah. This is written down. It's delicious.
Oh my God.
11 years later, in early 1959, Castro and his revolutionaries toppled the Batista dictatorship. American business interests controlled over 80% of Cuba's resources. So Castro said
80%?
Over 80%. Of their resources. So Castro set about redistributing land and reforming the educational system. He seized large Cuban land holdings and over 1 million acres of land from the United Fruit and two other American companies. He did offer compensation, but it was rejected. I don't know how much he offered, but they're just like, no. So like many non-aligned third world leaders during the Cold War, he accepted Soviet aid because it's all he had, basically. In April, Castro visited the U.S. and met briefly with Vice President Nixon, who dismissed him as naive about communism and later supported his assassination. So at this time, Castro was not a communist. He was a socialist. And this is documented time and time again in CIA reports and Pentagon reports. He was not a communist, even though we were saying that he was. He was a socialist.
Mm-hmm.
His brother was a communist, and his brother's best friend, Che Guevara, was a communist. But he...
I didn't actually realize that Che Guevara was... best friends with
Raul.
Castro's
brother. Yeah.
Huh. It's interesting, too, because many Americans today don't even actually realize there's a difference between socialism and communism.
No.
If you look at social media especially.
It is so sad. I see that so often, and I'm like, Stephanie, do not jump in there and educate them.
Because we all have our girl Google. To step away from social media, yeah. Because I would be like, excuse me.
Yeah. So when the U.S. and British oil companies refused to process Soviet oil at their Cuban refineries, Castro nationalized them and threatened to kick out all American business from the island. Eisenhower enacted a punishing trade embargo, denying the Cuban people, among other things, market for their sugar, which was their most profitable export by far.
Wow.
And the Chinese and the Soviets wanted to buy it.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't let them. So our biggest beef with Castro was that he was not a puppet. And he didn't crack down hard enough on communist propaganda within Cuba.
Yeah.
Like, he was just letting messages of communism just, like, be around and, like, wasn't locking them up and putting communists in jail.
I probably shouldn't say this, but it sounds a lot like the way we have treated Puerto Rico over the years, and look at Puerto Rico now.
Yeah.
And the position that they're in because they have played along with us for so many decades.
Yeah.
And now they're completely impoverished because we have just taken everything from them.
Yeah. So during the winter of 1959 through 1960, there was a significant increase in CIA supervised bombings and raids piloted by American-based Cuban exiles. Cuba, however, did not respond with violence or revenge. Rather, it followed the procedure required by an international law, like a bunch of saps. In July of 1960, Cuba called on the UN for help. Bless their hearts. They provided the Security Council with records of some 20 bombings, including the name of pilots, registration numbers from the planes, unexploded bombs, and other details. They called for a resolution of the conflict through diplomatic channels. No one fucking cared. No one cared.
Like, the UN didn't do anything?
Well, our ambassador at the time, I think it was Henry Cabot Lodge, said that we have no ill will towards Cuba. Meanwhile,
and yet we have all of these records of all these bombings.
Well, I'll get into it.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
So it's possible that he didn't know, but.
But even if he didn't know.
Yeah.
Fucking.
All of this
stuff. Cuba's going to the UN with proof.
Yeah.
And the UN is not doing anything.
Yeah. All of this stuff was like declassified. Like, at the time, it was like plausible deniability was like the name of the game. And like a lot of things were hidden. I mean, it made sense that they were hiding it because they were doing some dirt. Okay, so Operation Mongoose. Among the official groups collaborating on this operation were the CIA, FBI, NSA, Immigration and Naturalization Service, the U.S. Information Agency, and the U.S. Department of Defense and State. I'm not going to get into the weeds and talk about how missions were funded, but I will say that the budget for the CIA was $4.4 million, which is $37.7 million in today's money, and there was unspecified funds. A lot of it hasn't been declassified yet, but there was money coming in from CIA drug running.
Surprise.
I mean, drugs sell themselves.
Back to Noriega, too.
It's a good way to get money quickly, too. Oh, Jesus. So, yeah. So the And also private businesses with stakes in Cuba were also involved. This operation was far-reaching. There were offices all over the U.S., mostly in Florida, but also in the Caribbean and in South America. I'm going to put a link to the Bigot True podcast, where I got a lot of my information for this scandal from.
Bigot True?
Big If True. They're a podcast that does conspiracy theories, usually, but they took a break. They did this Summer of Truth. And it seems like a lot of their listeners were just like, what is this? We came here for conspiracy theories. We don't want truth. But they did a Summer of Truth where they did from Bay of Pigs to JFK's assassination.
Wow.
Yeah. So they did a really, really deep dive, 90 minutes on Operation Mongoose. There's two hosts and they both talked about it.
Wow.
So there's a lot of details there. If you want the nuts and bolts, definitely go there. It's episode 32. I will put it in the show notes. So Operation Mongoose was overseen by RFK. Which is JFK's brother, if everyone should know RFK, Robert Kennedy. But spearheaded by a young intelligence hotshot named Edward Lansdell. He was an advertising executive turned Air Force officer turned CIA operative. He had in the early 1950s masterminded the defeat of the communist uprising in the Philippines. Lansdell was an early practitioner of psychological warfare during covert missions. So he was considered a pioneer in anti-communist covert ops. In the Philippines, he spread rumors that vampires were loose in the jungle. His men then captured an enemy soldier and drained his blood and left him for guerrillas to see, and they saw, and they fled the area.
What the?
So he was doing shit like that. And JFK's like, oh, I like the cut of his jib.
I don't even.
Correct.
I can't even.
Again, all this has been declassified. So Lansdell received this assignment at the end of 1961, right after JFK took an L at the Bay of Pigs. This was back when administrations had to be competent.
For all of our older white listeners, okay. Taking an L means...
Taking a loss. Oh, wow. Yeah, I get... Okay, you're right. You're right. You're like, you did that for your mom. That's so sweet.
Yeah. Dear mom.
This was back when administrations had to be competent, so to flop so publicly was a huge scandal. Huge scandal at the time.
Wow.
Yeah, so Lansdell was assigned chief of operations of a top secret interagency task force known as the Caribbean Survey Group, soon to be designated for cover purposes Operation Mongoose. According to Wikipedia, there are 33 tasks considered under Operation Mongoose. Some were just plans, others were carried out. The number of tasks supposedly came from the fact that there are 33 living species of mongoose. But I found 32 tasks and 34 living species of mongoose. So I think this was just a joke, maybe, that stuck. But it was in Wikipedia.
Weird.
Anyways, who knows? I don't know what happened there. I'm not discussing all covert ops, because I don't have all day, frankly. I'm just talking about the fun ones. This will be my highlight reel of my favorites, from the trash to the whimsical. My scandal, this is actually the first time this will happen, will not progress chronologically at all, because mission dates were largely unspecified. Also, many plots were disguised in code, and much is still redacted.
Wow.
So okay. I just have like bits and pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel compelled to say that, please note that none of these plots are conspiracy theories. Like, everything is true. Everything is from the 1960s. Everything is digitally displayed in the National Archives for all to read. This will be my first link in the show notes. It's weird that I have to say this, but you'll see quickly why. Because gets crazy almost instantly. So I've broken operations into four categories: economic warfare, propaganda, terrorism, and assassination / Castro fuckery. I'm saving that for last because that's my favorite.
Wow.
So, economic warfare. The CIA greenlit major operations targeting the Cuban economy. Attacks were planned and executed against an oil refinery, a power plant, a sawmill, a floating crane in the Cuban harbor, all to undermine the Cuban economy and destabilize the country. Could you imagine if a foreign company just bombed a power plant?
America would lose its collective shit.
Bombed an oil refinery.
Yeah.
Crazy. So I'm just going to go through. I have them like in bunches. Some of them have operations names. Some of them are just, I have descriptions from the declassified documents. So moving on to another economic warfare item. The goal of Operation Full Up was to destroy confidence in Soviet fuel. After the Cuban Revolution, as I mentioned earlier, established a socialist state in 1959, the Soviet Union began sending crude oil to Cuba. At first, American refineries refused to refine this oil, but that didn't last long. Castro simply took over the oil refineries. So a plan was hatched to make the Cubans believe that the oil coming into their country was somehow defective. Quote, this is to be accomplished by introducing a known biological agent into the jet fuel storage facilities. The agent flourishes in jet fuel and grows until it consumes all the space inside the tank, one document said. So it would like eat up all the oil and it would just be an empty tank.
Holy shit. That's a thing?
There's no evidence that we have currently that this one happened.
Okay.
This was a plan that was declassified, but I just have the documentation. Okay. It seems like they were spitballing a lot of it.
He's
but
like,
yeah,
what if we came up with this thing?
Yeah, but I will mention the ones that actually did take place.
Okay.
So I'm moving on to propaganda. There was a scheme called Operation Bounty. Oh my God, this one's so good. The plan entailed airdropping leaflets over Cuba. The leaflets would list bounties for killing members of the Castro regime. Rewards would range between $0.02 and $1 million.
2 cents?
Correct. So the operation set the lowest bounty on Castro.
What?
So you could kill informants or people in his administration and be set financially for life. But if you killed Castro, you would get the equivalent of today's money of 16 cents.
But why?
It was supposed to like hurt his feelings.
Okay. Sure.
That he was like worth no money. In the report, the Senate report, the low bounty was meant to denigrate Castro.
Okay. I'm sure that he was like, you're stupid. Shut up.
Yeah. Like he'd see this leaflet and be like, okay, fine. I'm leaving. I'm going to Mexico. You can have the country now. Like what? Okay. Yeah. Operation True Blue was a plan to disrupt Cuban radio and TV broadcasts with anti-Castro propaganda. Their ideas for messages were so weak. Oh my God. Messages like Cuba, see, Russia, no.
What?
Yes. They were going to broadcast this on TV and people would be like, what? I didn't think of that. Messages like communism exploits the masses, or Castro and henchmen feast off the land while we are rationed, or Castro is a lunatic and should be put away, or Castro is the cause of all of our troubles, etc. So, quote, if approved, this operation would become a continuous project under the USIA, the planning document read. Do you know what the USIA is?
No.
Oh, okay. So it's our foreign propaganda production arm. Well, it's no longer called the USIA, but it's still around.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I mean, because, yeah. So there was Operation Good Times, which is really fun. This is a plan to create fake photographs of Fidel Castro living large like DJ Khaled. Oh, do you know who DJ Khaled is?
Okay. I only know
all who he does DJ is win. Khaled is. He has the best music.
Oh my God. I have a neighbor a few houses over.
I love that you know this because I have pictures on my desktop to show you if you didn't know him. It's like pictures of him with like a lion.
I have this neighbor that lives like three or four houses down and we're in Brooklyn. So all of our backyards butt up against each other.
Yeah.
And there's these neighbors that moved in a few months ago that like to, they like to sit outside and smoke bongs and drink champagne.
Oh yes, you did tell me about them. While
listening to DJ Khaled. And it's like, I was outside trying to garden or something. Like a
bougie old
white lady
being
one day.
Old.
Yeah.
Go on.
And I'm like sitting there and all of a sudden it was like, pew, 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 pew,
yes.
DJ Khaled.
Yes.
Like every 5 minutes, I'm like, oh my God, yes. I know who you are now.
Yes.
Shut up.
Okay.
I don't
my
need
pictures
to hear your
won't
name
come up.
Every 5 seconds.
Yeah, no, that is his thing. I think it's hard to live in the world and not know who DJ Khaled is if your ears work.
Because he just repeats his name every 5 seconds.
Sure does. Sure does. So the hope was to stir dissent and aid in some kind of, which is hilarious that they wrote this, homegrown uprising. And it's like you are making propaganda.
It's not homegrown.
Yeah. The plan was to prepare a desired photograph, such as a, quote, an obese Castro with two beautiful women within a room in the Castro residence, lavishly furnished, and a table brimming over with the most delectable Cuban food. The photo would be accompanied with a caption such as, quote, my ration is different, to give the impression that the Castro regime or Castro himself was living a very sexy good life while his people suffered.
Mm-hmm.
There was Operation Free Ride, which is another really great one. The CIA imagined a scenario in which planes would fly over Cuba, dropping valid one-way Pan Am tickets to cities like Caracas and Mexico City. The idea was to stage a mass exodus and to create unrest and dissent amongst the Cuban people. The planning documents explicitly state that no tickets to the U.S. will be dropped. Classic.
Ugh.
Classic. So there were two space-related covert ops. Oh, man. Okay, the first was called Operation Cover-Up. Which is like, you guys are so fucking lazy this one.
Yeah.
This whole plan from start to finish, I mean, is lazy. So it was a plan to convince Cuban officials that the U.S. space program was a cover for something else. A cover for what? It's unclear. Because military strategists didn't even think that far ahead. They just wanted to stir the pot and let Cubans believe the worst. So this one is just really fucking lazy.
Okay.
Yeah. Like, ugh, it's so, I'm embarrassed for them. The second, like, space-related idea was called Operation Dirty Trick, which, again, two on the nose. Oh, this one's bad. Okay. So, if elements of the space program failed, such as the upcoming orbit of John Glenn, we would make it look like it was the fault of the Cubans.
What?
Correct. Yeah. Quote, the objective was to provide irrevocable proof that should the Mercury manned orbit flight fail, the fault lies with Cuba. This is to be accomplished by manufacturing various pieces of evidence, which would prove electronic interference on the part of the Cubans. We were
I'm
preparing
speechless.
For John Glenn to die and blame it on the Cubans. I'm just like, does John Glenn know about this? Probably now.
Seriously.
Because it was declassified in the 70s. So there's Operation No Love Lost, which is perhaps the most juvenile of the group. The goal, harass Cuban pilots through radio communications just by calling them names. Things like, I'll get you, you red son of a gun. And
son of a gun?
Son of a gun.
What do they mean?
Quotes. I know, right? Well, it's the 60s. Yeah. So yes, they are you. This is like a bad word.
You red.
And they're
son
like,
of a
call
gun.
By name if appropriate. According to the CIA, this would be real trouble for Castro pilots in actual weather conditions, which is untrue.
I can't believe he said that to me.
No, I'm not. Oh my God, how do they know
I'm
my
no
name?
Son of a gun.
Now I'm going to crash. Like, it's just, it's absurd.
Oh my God.
So another plan called for an airdrop of, oh, this one's so stupid. I mean, they're all so stupid. An airdrop of toilet paper with pictures on alternate sheets of Fidel Castro and Nikita Khrushchev to drive, quote, Castro mad.
Oh, my God.
Free toilet paper is free toilet paper. Mm-hmm. Like, you can tell that it's just a bunch of men in a room just spitballing. No such thing as a bad idea. Operation Smasher was a plan to introduce faulty vacuum tubes into Cuba so that everything from military communications to home radios would be disrupted. The plan was to pay off employees of various suppliers and seed the country with vacuum tubes modified in such a manner to cause a short circuit. Kind of when compared to other ideas on the list, Operation Smasher seems pretty tame, but it still had the potential to do a lot of damage to the country's communication infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
There was a plan developed for a U.S. submarine to surface near the Cuban coast and fire star shells into the sky to convince Cubans that, quote, the second coming of Christ was imminent and that Christ was against Castro. It proposed firing star shells, which I believe is some sort of firecracker, from a submarine to illuminate Havana after dark on November 2nd, which was All Souls Day, in order to gain impact from Cuban superstitions.
I have no words. I just, know. Well, thanks for tuning in. This is the end of the show.
And I haven't even gotten...
has been beyond reproach.
Don't listen to him. I still have two more categories. Terrorism. Moving on. Terrorism.
Holy shit.
There was Operation Invisible Bomb, a plan to hit Cuba with sonic booms to create confusion and damage. At first, Cubans would no doubt believe that they were under some sort of attack by isolated bombings. But over time, the shrieks would simply become an overwhelming presence of sustained terror, end quote.
Jesus.
It would cause not only apprehension, these are their words, but varying degrees of malicious damage as well, i.e. break all the windows on the street of Havana. The best part of the plan, as the government saw it, was that it was relatively safe, while leaving no tangible evidence that it was conducted by the Americans. It can be planned and executed with minimum effort and expense. Another plan, this to me is the worst plan, by far. For biological agents, which would appear, quote, appear to be of natural origins to produce crop failures. They hope that a man-made famine would cause the citizens to revolt.
But this is another one where, like, it didn't
happen. It didn't happen.
They didn't have the actual technology.
I will get there. Yes. Ugh. One of the members present, a man named General Carter, emphasized the extreme sensitivity of such an operation and the disastrous results that would flow from something going wrong, particularly if it was obvious attribution to the U.S. Fears were only calmed when it was made clear that, quote, any such sabotage could be made to appear as a result of local Cuban disaffection or natural disaster, but that the U.S. must avoid external activities such as release of chemicals, etc., unless they could be completely covered up. So that was the issue, that they couldn't guarantee it could be covered up. So it's like, oh, it's too risky.
But, like, obviously this wasn't even a real thing.
Yeah.
But if it had been, what about the possibility that something like that would spread to the United States as well? Like,
yeah.
Guys.
I mean, they weren't thinking like that. They had another plan for infiltrating and distributing small explosives to anti-Castro Cubans. However, in a later report, there is a major problem with this op. Can you guess what it is?
My brain is just mush at this point.
I'm sorry.
No.
I'm sorry. Their issue is that they couldn't find anyone who wanted to do this to Castro. Uh-huh.
Okay.
Because the majority of the population, like most governments, were kind of just like neutral.
Even though he had a 2-cent bounty on his head.
I know. So they couldn't find anyone willing to blow him up, despite what many exiles told the CIA. There was Operation Raindrop, a plan for weather control over Cuba. The U.S. wanted to seed clouds off Cuba, which would produce heavy rains during the cane harvesting season, their biggest crop. The author of the paper explained that he was told the technology was state-of-the-art and could permit the coloring of the rain, either red or green, so like just to freak them out.
This is not a thing.
This is the thing that we all have access. Again, National Archives. Like, it is unbelievable. The things that have been, a lot hasn't been declassified, but the things that have, you're just like jaw drop. There was a note on one of the pages that said, needs considerable more sabotage. Like, someone wrote this on top of like a plan. And it's like, you're doing a lot of, I think you guys are good on the sabotage. It's wild.
This is literally
wild.
Like, this is like 2019 level understanding of science and technology. Like, I'm gonna fire a gun into a hurricane and the hurricane is gonna be scared and go away.
Exactly.
You're
gonna hurt the hurricane's feelings.
Yeah.
I'm
gonna make clouds.
Yeah. And rain and green water onto their crops during a season that's supposed to be dry.
Girl.
Yeah. Girl. Girl's right.
This is not possible.
Okay, so there was Operation Breakup. I need to get through this all.
I'm sorry.
I'm almost done, but like, it's insane. There was Operation Breakup. American planners had an idea to sabotage Cuban boats, cars, and planes so people would lose faith in them. The plan was to secretly introduce corrosive materials to cause aircraft, vehicle, and boat accidents. So they were just going to kill some civilians, and then they'd be like, thanks, Castro. Now I'm dead.
Thanks a lot, Obama.
Okay, so I'm getting to the last segment, which is assassinations and Castro fuckery, and it's real fun. So the CIA repeatedly tapped their pals in the mafia to try to kill Castro, because there were mafia-run casinos that were taken, so they were like pissed. There were some like Sicilians, notorious Sicilians in Chicago that were just like willing to kill Castro.
Yeah, yeah.
The CIA gave them various like poisonous things, an idea for poisonous gambling bills, poisonous ice cream, poisonous chocolate milkshake.
Wow.
There was an idea for a psychedelic speech. The CIA planned to sabotage Castro's speeches by spraying his broadcast studio with a chemical that would make him suffer similar hallucinations to LSD. The LSD-like substance was abandoned because it was too unstable. So not all attempts were on Castro's life. Sometimes the target was to just undermine his public appearance as like a strong man, like a charismatic, like bearded, sexy man. Other plots included spiking the dictator's cigars with a chemical that would disorient him, hoping that he would smoke one before delivering one of his marathon speeches, and he would say something crazy. Spoiler alert, he never smoked any of the cigars, which they actually did lace.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
There was the exploding cigar plot, which actually did happen. Perhaps it's the most famous plot to kill Castro. The CIA poisoned a box of his favorite cigars just a year after Castro seized power. The agency spiked the cigars with a botulinum toxin strong enough to kill anybody who put it in their mouth. The cigars were delivered to an unidentified person, the name still redacted, in 1961, according to a report, but it's unclear what happened to them after that. Needless to say, he didn't smoke them. Hopefully no one did, but who knows?
Jesus.
Yeah. There's a box of poisonous cigars out there.
Botulism cigars.
Yeah, correct. There was the poison pen, another CIA plan to kill Castro using a hypodermic needle concealed within a pen. The needle claimed to be so fine that the victim would not notice its insertion, a report said. The needle was to be rigged with poison and injected into Castro by a highly placed Cuban official who was in discussions with the CIA. However, this Cuban official did not think much of the device and complained to the CIA, why can't they, quote, come up with something more sophisticated?
Good fucking question.
Yeah, it's like, I'm not going to die for this. Like, this thing is huge.
Yeah. Oh my
God. There were also plots to make Castro also known as the Beard in declassified documents. Like, they just called him the Beard.
Yeah.
An object of ridicule rather than to kill him. The plan was to dust his shoes with thallium salts, which according to them would have made Castro's iconic beard fall out. It's the source of his power, you know. The CIA thought that his power and his charisma came from his beard, and I agree. But Castro canceled the trip, so the agents weren't given the opportunity to dust his shoes. But this was a real plan.
Good Lord.
Right. There was the painted seashell. Intelligence officials thought that they could use his love of scuba diving to kill him. They planned to hide explosive inside a large seashell and paint it with exotic colors to lure the attention of the ocean-loving Castro. But they couldn't find a shell big enough to put... actual documentation about this. There was the idea for the contaminated wetsuit. The CIA planned to contaminate one of Castro's diving suits with a fungus that would produce a chronic debilitating skin disease. This plan was abandoned and the poisonous suit never left the laboratory. But again, they did it. One of Castro's former lovers, Marita Lorenz, was also recruited as a hit woman. She was given poison pills to put in Castro's drink. But Castro found out about the attempt and is said to have handed her his gun to use instead. Quote, you can't kill me. Nobody can kill me, he said, Miss Lorenz told the New York Daily News. And he kind of smiled and chewed on his cigar. I felt deflated. He was so sure of me. He just grabbed me. We made love.
Amazing.
Amazing, right? So this list is far from comprehensive, but it does highlight the desperation to see Cuba destroyed and Castro overthrown. Why were so few of these operations carried out as far as we know? My thought is probably because most of the plans were really fucking stupid.
So stupid.
Childish. Childish and stupid and lazy.
I mean, childish is like, doesn't even begin to describe. I know. Like, you're talking about doing things that are not possible because the technology does not exist.
Yeah,
it doesn't exist.
Yeah. Sci-fi. Other people claim that the U.S. didn't do it because they were hyper aware of looking bad to the rest of the world, especially in Latin America. Also, many of these proposals were nothing short of treason, and these weren't low-level bureaucrats coming up with these ideas. These were top brass military and intelligence officers. Like the hundreds of other assassination plots against Castro, all failed. How many times do you think Castro was... How many assassination attempts? How many do you think?
I'm going to say 25.
Bless your heart. Tux is the sweetest man I know. 638.
600?
638. I can give you the... Okay, so 38 under Eisenhower, 42 under JFK, 72 under Johnson, 184 under Nixon, 64 under Carter, 197 under Reagan, 16 under H.W. Bush, and 21 under Clinton, for a total of 638 assassination attempts that the U.S. lists.
I am...
Shook?
Gooped.
Gooped. Duh.
Gooped.
Gooped.
Holy fucking gooped. Shit.
Gooped. The operation to kill the Beard would be renamed Operation Executive Action and would span a half a century in 10 administrations. Castro once joked that if surviving assassination attempts was an Olympic sport, he'd have the gold medal, which he would.
Yeah.
Such a great sense of humor. So please note that only one time in the 1,000-plus pages of declassified documentation did a single U.S. official raise something that kind of resembled a faint moral objection to any of this, though it's unclear what plan caused the objection. Really? So do you think that you could have had a great career with the CIA back then?
If you were drinking
that Cold War Kool-Aid, obviously.
Literally, if it didn't take anything more than like being like, well, what if the world turned inside out? Like,
there was no such thing as a bad idea.
What if I made the sky purple?
Yeah.
Like,
but just over Cuba. Like, what?
That's
a thing that could happen.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Eyes dart back and forth. Mm-hmm. Change subject. I hope that my scandal can put election interference within a broader context. We must be mindful that this country's shockingly well-documented history of foreign meddling and terrorism when getting hot and bothered over Russian bots and Ukrainian phone calls. This is the smallest of small potatoes.
Yeah.
And yeah, Operation Mongoose just proves that. The end.
Jeez Louise. Holy shit.
Right.
It wasn't just JFK, though.
No, it wasn't just JFK. But all of those plots were done in the 60s. Those were all under Lansdell.
Okay.
The 600 assassination plots, yeah. Like, I don't know what they were.
Yeah.
And it's all, I mean, it all hasn't been declassified, but so much has, and it's wild. Every page, your mouth is just like, what? And on the National Archives, you can go by administrations to see all the covert special ops.
Mm-hmm.
So there's like Guatemala, there's the Philippines, there's like all the shit wow. they did in Saigon. I mean, there's still black bars over certain things.
We love to meddle.
It is our favorite. It is literally our favorite.
People really don't understand why Puerto Rico is in such a mess. This is why. Pay attention.
Yeah.
We have designed it.
I mean, I didn't know all this shit.
No, I mean, I had no idea.
I knew that there was fuckery. I knew that they tried to kill Castro, but I had no clue that they were thinking about like faking some crop shortage to cause a man-made famine.
Yeah.
Like they were willing to kill everyone just to get one man. Just because he took away like American fruit. Like, get the fuck over
it. And like, hello, one fucking ear of corn makes it across the fucking ocean and you're like, oh, now we have that crop famine too? Oops.
Yeah, oops. Thankfully, a lot of the really stupid plans did not leave the laboratory, like, didn't get off the ground because they were really fucking stupid.
It didn't even make it into the laboratory because the scientists would be like, are you fucking kidding me?
Yeah, are you fucking kidding? Get out of here. Yeah. I wish none of this was true.
Ain't that some shit?
I know. I really love Operation Free Ride, I think, is my favorite.
Damn.
The one where they were going to drop one-way tickets, but not to the U.S.
But I just...
That one is really funny to me. They're just like, oh, no, no, no. You go to Mexico City.
You can't
City.
Come here.
Yeah. We want you to leave Cuba, but not... Don't come here.
Don't come here.
What?
Yeah. That sounds vaguely familiar. Well, that was a story.
Are you okay? You don't look okay.
I'm just,
you look
like,
stunned.
My brain is mush. Like, yeah. I just don't even...
You thought you were Goop before.
I know, yeah.
You were wrong.
Well, on that note, should we cheers?
Yes.
America's history is juicy. We just add gin.
And milk.
Or in this case, milk. Thank you so much for listening to Beyond Reproach, for putting up with us.
You know how you can like tell that someone's smiling, like as they talk?
Yeah.
I hear the you trying to keep it together.
I'm literally like one step away from falling apart, just melting into a pile of giggles.
Oh.
This has been Tux Lurzel.
It's Stephanie Domingo.
Thank you to Tim Clough, our sound engineer, podfather, and
love of our
editor.
Lives.
The love of our lives. He makes everything better.
Yes.
We couldn't do this without him. Please rate, review, and subscribe. Written reviews are especially important. If you like us, tell a friend.
Tell two friends.
Tell two friends.
Or anyone who likes podcasts. Some people are very
That's a good point.
Yeah.
Yes.
Anyone who likes podcasts,
yeah,
I think, would be into this.
Lots of people don't.
Yeah.
Follow us on social media, Beyond Reproach Pod on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
And Reddit.
Beyond Reproach Pod on Reddit, too?
It is Beyond Reproach.
Period.
Period.
Motherfucker.
Yeah.
We're also on Patreon if anyone would like to show us some love and support. I guess that's it.
Yeah.
Goodbye.
Bye. Toodaloo.